Do you really think all this is an accident? You think we crashed on this place by coincidence? Especially this place? We were brought here for a purpose, for a reason, all of us. Each one of us was brought here for a reason.
Brought here. And who brought us here, John?
The island.
Look, you want to push the button? You do it yourself.
If it's not real, then what are you doing here, Jack? Why did you come back? Why do you find it so hard to believe?
Why do you find it so easy?
It's never been easy!
It's a leap of faith, Jack.
Two players, two sides. One is light, one is dark.
I see you in another life, brother. We have to go back!
We're going to need to watch that again.
Hello and welcome to The Storm, a Lost Rewatch podcast. My name is Dave Gonzalez and I'm at the support group with Locke because nobody's put Tom Bombadil in a Lord of the Rings movie and I'm just barely keeping it together.
My name is Joanna Robinson and I'm in the anger management support group with Locke because TV legend Katie Sagal doesn't have an Emmy yet, and that is bullshit.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I am in the support group with John Locke, who is not bald yet, because I keep going to the doctor's office and seeing Fox News on, and I don't think that I should be subjected to that anywhere. I think I should be able to live a life where I get to avoid Fox News, and I don't think it's fair for the doctor to put that on.
You are listening to the episode 4, season 2, episode 3, orientation. That's right. We have finally gotten through this like three-part opening to season 2, and that means we are halfway through our six-part miniseries before we jump off to talk about Star Wars for the rest of the year. But if this is your first time joining us, you are tuning in for the Lost Rewatch podcast. We are rewatching the ABC series Lost, and we split our podcast into two sections. One we call The Calm, in which we only talk about episodes we've already watched for the rewatch, as if we're, you know, watching it for the first time. And the second part we call The Storm, because it involves spoilers. A storm of spoilers, or what would be spoilers, because all of us talk about things that have been addressed in later seasons of Lost, or in the intervening years, as we've compiled all this Lost knowledge. You could check your show notes on your podcasting device right now for time codes. We also have an interview that's also in the time codes. Everything right there, format in the notes. That is The Storm. We used to be called The Storm of Spoilers. You could support us at patreon.com/stormofspoilers. There you get a whole bunch of different bonus content. Some is Lost related, some is not Lost related. This week we managed to explain some developments in the Game of Thrones and Star Wars universe for our Patreon subscribers. You can subscribe there at multiple levels. The bottom most $1 level gets you access to our community Slack, which is the greatest part on the internet. And I'm sure there they will talk about how we have a live show coming up November 21st at the Canyon Theater at the Boulder Public Library. We're going to be talking about the Star Wars original trilogy at that live show. Joanna, is there a place people could go to reserve a spot at this free live show?
Oh my God, yes. If you go to soslive.com, or as I like to call it, soslives, how.com. Either way, you can go register, and we really encourage you to register. We need to know, sort of like, we don't need to know. We would like to know how many people are coming, so we can make sure we have seats for everyone. But the event is free. You can find out more information about what's going on with us generally over at stormpodcast.com. If you have questions, comments, or concerns for us, or just like to talk to us, you can email us, hosts@stormpodcast.com. Find us on Twitter @stormpodcast. Just like so many places to find us, guys. So come find us. Join us. Lost is happening. Star Wars is next. It's a great time to be alive in the fandom, unless you're Weiss and Benioff. Okay, so we are going to read quickly a review that we got from a listener before I hop over to a quick listener email. So this review is titled, the person's iTunes handle, which I can only assume was created just for us, is, are you ready? This person has named themselves Hatch, Hatch, Hatch. And the title of the review says, real 5-star review, 5 stars. Thank you all for diving into Lost. I knew it would be great after it was announced, and I recalled Joanna talking about the Lost-esque stationary bike scene in the Westworld podcast. What a great Westworld moment, just for the reportedly accidental callback to Lost. Probably the highlight of Westworld for me, but I guess that's an opinion for another review. I've listened to lots of the host's other pods, but I had to join them on Patreon for this one and the spoilery interviews. Great job on this, and can't wait to hear the rest, and also jump into Star Wars with you all. So thank you to Hatch, Hatch, Hatch for that.
Hatch, 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 Hatch.
For that review. And then we've got a great email from Ashley Olson. She signed it Ashley Olson, not that one. So we'll just say that right off the bat. Ashley Olson, not that one, wrote us.
Or is it?
It's actually Mary Kate. Wrote us this email. Hi, Joanna, Dave, and Neil, long time listener, first time writer. I found your podcast a few years ago in the throes of my obsession with Hamilton. I searched.
Hey.
For-
Whoa.
I know. I know. We caught one. I searched for podcasts about Hamilton, and it suggested your episode from 2016. I was excited to hear people talk about something that I like so much. I loved the charisma that all three of you have. I got hooked on the off season tour. And did an MCU rewatch listening to each episode you guys put out for each movie. I also love listening to your Star Wars episodes. All that being said, I've never watched Game of Thrones, so once season 8 started, I was sad to jump off the wagon for a while and looked forward to what you were going to do after the conclusion of Game of Thrones. I was so glad when I heard the promo for the Lost rewatch. Lost is my favorite show of all time, and I couldn't wait to take a deep dive into it with a podcast that does such a great job of both recapping and theorizing so many other things that I have loved. I came to Lost on season 4 when I was 20 years old, working second shift at a hotel, and would get home to a sleeping house and had nothing to do. Before the 4th season of Lost started, they had a push that all previous seasons were available to stream online. So I jumped in and started from the beginning, watching on ABC.com. I was hooked. I have the Lost Encyclopedia that DK put out, and I'm doing my rewatch on DVD since I own all seasons. My binge style for this rewatch, my second Lifetime Lost rewatch, is a disc at a time, 4 episodes, and then patiently wait for the corresponding podcast episodes to come out before I move on to the next disc. One of my favorite parts of Lost was looking for hints and speculating about things. I was eager to read Doc Jensen's recaps on Entertainment Weekly the next morning. We'll come back to that, Ashley. I love to read the long articles and either learn new things or pump my fist when I notice something that Doc also noted as an important clue. One of your recent episodes discussed the absence of GIFs or GIFs for the show and how that was not there was not a huge online presence. I agree. The main site I visited for screen grabs and connections was Dark UFO, www.darkufo.blogspot.com. I also used to go to Dark UFO. This helped me to see tons of ties and hints that I didn't notice while I was watching live. And yes, of course, I love to live tweet reactions to later season episodes as they air. And then she mentions how when she was watching Orange is the New Black for the first time, she noticed how much Orange is the New Black kind of steals from Lost's structure. I so enjoy your podcast and having so much fun listening to your info on Lost. One of my favorite parts is when Neil tells us about trivia, particular to that episode, how it was shot, when it aired, how they did the rain in the jungle, etc. A piece of trivia that I would love to know is who the heck voices previously on Lost. Oh, my phone went off right when I said that. So it was like you and me at the same time. Previously on Lost. Those three words gave me thrills, just like some of the music cues and the yeah, boom. I don't know if I got that. I don't know if I got that onomatopoeia beautifully. A fun note, back in the day, I had a dating profile. You had a username and then a tagline that was like 75 characters max. My tagline was, "Whoa!" Unfortunately, the dating site proved unsuccessful, but I have no regrets about the best tagline ever. Keep up the great work. Thanks for a great show, and don't fall down. Ashley Olson, not that one. So, We know who did the previously on Lost. Wasn't it like an ABC exec or?
Yeah, it was
Lloyd Braun.
Lloyd Braun. Yeah.
So that was Lloyd Braun, who was like,
he's the one who got fired for greenlighting Lost.
For greenlighting Lost, but he is forever. There's actually a later reference to this. I was just watching a season 5 episode, and there's like I think I could say this in the comm. There is a TV show and season that is like referred to, an in-universe fake TV show that's referred to in a season 5 episode, and I won't say the name of it, but they go, previously on blank, the name of the fake TV show. And I was like, that's a Lloyd Braun nod, I'm pretty sure. Anyway, so that was from Ashley. A great email. Really appreciate it. The reason I got so excited that Ashley mentioned Doc Jensen, aka Jeff Jensen, is because that's our guest this week. Entertainment Weekly's Jeff Jensen.
It's like Ashley summoned this interview into existence with her email.
Okay, so the thing, we'll set up Jeff a little bit more later on in this episode before we get to the interview, which is a very, very, very good, very deep, he's so thoughtful interview. I really love talking to Jeff. But Jeff, okay, so like, say you're a Game of Thrones fan and you liked watching Game of Thrones. And you maybe you read Joanna Robinson of Vanity Fair, you read Kim Renfro from Business Insider, you read James Hibbert for his interviews, you listened to Bald Move, you had all your various resources that you like to listen to. When you watched Lost, you like just read Jeff Jensen pretty much. Jeff Jensen was like the Lost guy. We didn't have the Game of Thrones person. We had some Game of Thrones people. Jeff was the Lost guy. His like recaps, if you want to call them that, on Entertainment Weekly were legendary, so much so that he is now working with Damon Lindelof on Watchmen. So we talked a little bit about that. We talked mostly about Lost, and we talked about this episode, which is his favorite episode of Lost. And so we will go to that later, but I'm just so thrilled and excited that we got to have Jeff on for this episode of the Storm podcast. All right, I did all my things. Now it's time for something else.
Yay, what a great podcast we have. Neil,
yes.
Remind us what happened as we finally resolve this cliffhanger of guns down in the hatch on the island.
Indeed, it is season 2, episode 3, Orientation, which is, as Dave mentioned, sort of the third part of the opening trilogy of episodes to season 2. This episode was directed by Jack Bender, who we've mentioned many times. It was written by Javier Grillo-Marswatch and Craig Wright. It aired on October 5th, 2005. It continues to take place, as did the previous couple episodes, on days 44 and 45 on the island. In flashbacks, we watch as John works through his daddy issues at group therapy, then looks out and meets Helen, who turns out to be pretty wonderful. We learn that John also has been driving to and sitting outside of his father's house. He just really wanted to know why he stole his kidney. Helen assists him in stopping, sort of. We'll get back to that one. On the island, Michael, the many orientations on the island. This is the most literal episode title, because Michael, Sawyer, and Jin receive an orientation about what Ana Lucia and the folks in the back of the plane have been up to, and then she steals their gun and leaves them in a hole. Desmond and a mysterious film give Locke and Jack an orientation for what's going on in the hatch. They have decidedly divergent opinions on the veracity of these claims. And then Desmond runs away, brother. Kate, Hurley, and Saeed also learn some stuff about the hatch, which I assume will come to play later. It all ends with Jack taking a leap of faith and John taking the first shift in the hatch. Lostpedia fact of the week this week. This episode was originally intended to be the final appearance of Desmond, but if maybe you heard Joanna and Henry Ian Cusick talk about this in part of the interview last week, he was eventually brought back.
Yes. This is not, trust us, we did not get super excited to see Desmond just for 3 episodes.
Right.
You know, we debated whether or not we should say this, but yes.
The only reason I brought it up is maybe not bringing it up is to make the joke that Desmond runs off into the forest never to be seen again. And that's the last we see of Desmond.
It's it really is just too hard.
Into a jungle of mystery.
It's too hard to do that.
See another jungle, brother.
Yeah, because Desmond's on a lot of posters going forward. So, Desmond's not running. Not gone forever. Anyway, this week's opening question, who took the bigger loss in this episode? Jack losing the argument to Locke, or Sawyer losing his gun and his manhood to Ana Lucia?
I'm going to go actually with Jack, but not for the moment you're talking about. I wanted to talk about how Jack is
how many losses does Jack take in this episode?
Pursuing Desmond with like a gun, and is going to like get some goddamn answers, and then he's like, I'm married her, and then cries himself into uselessness as Desmond's like, oh, so fuck it off now, and runs off the series as Jack weeps.
I love that line reading. I married her!
I married her!
I've
watched all of Lost up to this point, and I do not know how I'm supposed to retake that line reading still.
I actually love this Jack in this episode, and I love Matthew Fox in this episode. So I'm not here. This is not a Joanna Hayes on Jack for an hour episode at all. That being said, I married her. It's like makes me laugh every time.
Jack. Okay, so Jack takes the bigger loss. I will say that, you know, shout out to Sawyer, who really gets sort of owned in the con game this week, and I love how it just happens all within this one tight episode. That it's just like, oh, Sawyer got taken. It's great.
I mean, you know, look out for the very, very low-rise bootcut jean. Don't underestimate someone in a low-rise bootcut jean.
That would be a most 2005 thing?
Oh, absolutely. Her jeans.
Ana Lucia's jeans?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which, spoiler alert, I'm pretty sure she only wears those jeans for the whole entire show. So, yeah.
And then she only wears jeans for most of the Fast and Furious. She just really loves that kind of jean.
Really, since Girl Fight, has anybody seen the lower half of Michelle Rodriguez's legs?
Maybe she just always has
Blue
those
crush,
jeans on.
Bro.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I apologize for forgetting about Blue Crush.
Never has a theory been blown up so quickly by a surfing movie.
Worst lost theory, Ana Lucia has no actual shins. Let's stay with the others complex that's just been getting weirder down in the hole. I actually think that this is evidence that season two Sawyer has, like, developed a new softer side, because as Ana Lucia points out, he did not shoot any of the others when they, you know, rushed at him with a big stick, which he says he was, you know, too busy to notice, or maybe forgot the gun. But I think it's just a softer Sawyer. The season two Sawyer is not the Sawyer that you think is going to randomly shoot somebody, now that we've seen, you know, Shannon and Charlie randomly shoot at people.
Well, and this too, right on the heels of Adrift, where there was a lot of time talk, or what was it? Was it in Adrift, or was it in the first episode, where there's a lot of talk about Sawyer both wanting to die and not exactly being a killer? So there's been a lot of exploration about what Sawyer is and what Sawyer isn't leading up to this. And I love how, you know, Ana Lucia sniffs him out as not being a killer sort of immediately.
Yeah,
so it makes her a very, like, on the survivor level, just that one moment makes her a very dangerous player, because you're like, oh, not only is she clever enough to, you know, go through with this whole plot, but she's also very perceptive of what's going on. So I like it.
And I like the episode for the way it, you know, uses Ana Lucia and her reveal, despite the fact that she's been in the opening credits this whole time. So we finally got there. A lot of this episode feels like we finally got there. Which I think brings us back to the hatch, where we pick up right where we left the end of 2 weeks ago, with a, you know, Desmond pointing a gun at Locke. Kate this time finally manages to shuffle down into an armory.
Are we done checking in on the pit without me getting to talk about Michelle Rodriguez?
Oh, we can talk more about Michelle Rodriguez. Yeah, no, let's stay in the pit. Go ahead.
Pit. Well, I do want to say, we saw a gentleman swing a mighty club in this episode. That was intriguing. But our listeners were discussing this episode in our Patreon-supported Slack. You, too, can join them for the low, low price of a dollar. They were talking about it, and someone described Michelle Rodriguez being pulled up out of the pit like a pirate queen. And I'm like, that was a pirate.
She really does. It's such an awesome exit.
Yes. She just gets fully hoisted out of there. It's so good.
And seemingly very comfortable with the gun, at least more comfortable than any of our losties have been so far.
Yeah, it's, I love Michelle Rodriguez. I'm glad that we didn't just see Ana Lucia order tequila with Jack and never again. But like, it's so funny because, I remember asking, a bunch of our listeners in the Patreon, like, when she first shows up at the end of season one, I was like, what'd you guys think? Crazy. They're like, oh, we just assumed she's going to be back. I don't know. She's on the cover of certain things. Michelle Rodriguez is in the show. And I was like, oh, I guess it's not as exciting this many years later.
See, this is the same. It's the same thing as the Desmond thing that we just talked about. It's like, well, like, people know that, like, they didn't die in their first episode, at least.
So anyway, Ana Lucia. That's all.
And her jeans.
The jeans, iconic. Pirate queen, love it as a descriptor. Her getting one up on Sawyer's, great stuff. So
also much better pronunciation of others by Jin this week.
That's true. And correct subtitling on the previously on by the subtitling people.
Yeah, I mean if we're gonna hold their feet to the fire 15 years later. Last week, then we gotta, you know, when they do it right, we gotta call it out.
Yeah, which is actually, it's not the only thing that's digitally altered this week, I don't think, because I think the picture that Jack finds of Desmond in the hatch, has actually been changed for all releases from original broadcasts, because of some later casting that we can't talk about. Much like I'm hesitant to talk much more about the pit.
I don't even know what you're talking. Well, I do know what you're talking about, but now I need to rewatch the episode and more again. Well, poor me. Okay. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, which is why I was sort of like pivoting off the pit a little bit faster. Not only because I love everything that's happening in the hatch. No, I'm not going to chant for the pit. It's a hatch chant, and it will remain a hatch chant.
Pit. Okay.
But we'll be back to the pit. But I also wanted to point out that I love how in the show's way, she's like, oh, you're going to do the old sick prisoner when she's doing the old fake prisoner. And I'm like, ah, yes, someone who's aware of all the tropes of being caught in a pit. I think it was Javier who wrote this episode who said that you're eventually just doing Star Trek no matter what thing you're doing. And caught in a pit. Is definitely caught in a pit with a maybe stranger is definitely a Star Trek trope.
Speaking of, I don't want to, I'm going to try so hard not to spoil my interview with Jeff because it was like, I just want everyone to experience it for themselves. But there's a thing that happens in this episode, that I guess, Damon Lindelof still uses in his writer's room as shorthand for a kind of plot. And he calls it a, shoot the computer plot. So.
Oh, yeah, good. Right back to the hatch, right where I wanted to be. So Kate is in the armory, gets a shotgun, manages to get the drop on Desmond, but Desmond gets a shot off, shooting the computer, causing this week's... I don't want to spoil the idea if you guys are going to talk about what this particular thing is, but I like how it adds interior ticking clock already to our... third part of a three-part pilot in a hatch of mystery, escalating mystery on top of mystery. And like I alluded to, I think last week, I really like how our hatch plot manages to answer questions with other crazy questions because as Desmond struggles to try to fix the computer so they all don't die, he instructs Locke and Jack to watch a orientation film, number 3 of 6, it says, for the Swan Station, that introduces us to the idea of the Dharma Initiative, a parapsychology research group that created this lab. Then because of an incident, the button needs to be pressed every 108 minutes. And we have our, like, what... should be a super simple dramatic set of events, which is there's a button that either does or does not save the world, which kind of seems dumb when you just reduce it to a sentence, but it becomes the dramatic threshold for a run of episodes, starting here with like a showdown between Jack and Locke on if pushing the button is even real. Every day. Well, and Desmond.
Every day.
I want to throw it to Neil.
I'm going to say it here. Sorry. Because we already referenced the spoilery part of my conversation with Henry Ian Cusick, who plays Desmond, we should say that there is interaction in this episode where, according to him, Jack Bender asked him to play it like 9 million different ways. Right? Play it angry, play it curious, play blah, blah, blah. And when he was done, he said that Terry O'Quinn said to him, I think that was your audition. Like, basically, they hired him for 3 episodes. They liked him immediately. And then Jack Bender just did like a little Dharma Initiative thought experiment on him and was like, try to do this whole gamut.
He's like, ooh, he would push the button.
Yeah. And apparently he passed. And we will probably see him again. So, yeah.
Because otherwise he would just run off into the jungle, never to be seen again, apparently, which, you know, probably not. He probably would have popped up. Maybe, I don't know. But it would have been weird, I think, ending the series, the way it was, with one of the hanging questions being what happened to Desmond. Not that there isn't the equivalent questions by the time we get to the end of the series, but we'll definitely get there. I want to talk about a film plot device and how brilliant it is. Specifically, just the idea they shot this little bit of film, I believe, on the Alias sets to sort of like keep it secret, keep it safe, and have taken out, you know, frames and chunks to sort of create this jerky editing, but so specifically taken out chunks to create further mysteries. Like, don't use the computer for what? What about like the incident? What's like the greater purpose of the lab? All these things seemingly would have been explained in different parts of the orientation video that we don't have. Starting it off with a title card that says 3 of 6. Is the first of many such like rug pullings in this season of Lost, I think, that has you out there searching for other missing pieces that may or may not actually exist. It's fantastic. And Neil, you said that this might be your favorite episode of Lost. What does it for you with orientation?
Yeah, well, I think you described a little bit of it. I mean, for me, as I was rewatching this, I'm remembering sort of the time of my life. This aired at the end of 2005. I actually started Film School Rejects the beginning of 2006. So this was in the time leading up to like my whole career starting. This is easily one of the episodes upon which the first church of Crazy Town was built, because there is so much stuff in this episode. It really did feel like at the time a huge data dump of stuff from the show, because there was so much mystery, and this episode just really is the first one. And what will become impressive to people is when they keep doing this, but the first one that just like blows a bunch of stuff wide open, you know, like the Dharma Initiative was really nothing. I mean, we talked about the logo on the shark, but we didn't really talk about it in the context.
We could only say the word Dharma. We couldn't say the word initiative last week. Now so we can just say initiative.
In this one video, we get so many questions, so much information. The other thing I really love about it is it just feels like every moment that Matthew Fox and Terry O'Quinn are on screen together, it is just this duel of who can just give it their all harder. Mm-hmm. And it's so good. All this stuff in the hatch, these arguments between, because they're having the argument that the show has been building for a season and a couple of episodes. And they're just, I mean, and it's clear as you sort of watch this occur that this is an argument that's going to have to be had a bunch of times. because you see, you know, Saeed's not even reacting to the substance of it yet. He's just here to fix the computer. Kate's not really reacting to the substance. She's just here to look at the clock and panic, you know, and Hurley's just there to be like, dude. So it's really interesting. They spend so much time with just Jack and Locke being the only two people sort of arguing this question as the clock ticks down. Yeah, it's one of my all time favorite Lost episodes by far because of the combination of how good the character stuff is with the immense amount of crazy information this episode tries to give us. I mean, just think about the Ana Lucia thing. I remember that as being like a huge deal. Like, oh my God, she's back. You know, we didn't know if we were going to see her. It's funny because we just talked about how it's easy to not be as surprised nowadays, but back when it was airing, it was wild.
Other survivors from the plane.
Yeah, it was like you had no idea that there was anybody from the back of the plane. And this sort of, and this opened up that door where it was like, well, if she's there, are these other people from the back of the plane? Are there more people on the island? What's going on? You know, it's just, well, that's when the theories just started to pour.
Woo! And
So this is another one where I really like the flashback, but I do think that it's kind of, I don't know. Joanna, is the flashback of Lux
yes,
being encouraged to make a leap of faith by giving up his anger at all similar to the leap of faith that Locke asked Jax to make by pressing the button?
Once again, I don't want to spoil my conversation with Jeff Jensen too much, but this episode, rewatching it, I had this like eureka moment watching it. And then talking to him, I was like, oh, he had this eureka moment a million years ago, which is how much this episode ties the daddy issues, which we've talked about, to these larger issues of like God and faith and, you know, the moment for me, and I talked to Jeff about this specifically, but he also said a lot of other stuff, so I don't feel so bad retreading this, is when Locke is sitting in the car with his dad and he goes, I just need you to know why. Why did you do this to me? That is a question that like a Job figure asks God. Well, actually Job doesn't because he never questions, but like other figures ask God, right? Why? Why did you take this from me? Why did you do this for me? Why? And his, you know, Anthony Cooper, because he's a fucking asshole, you know, is like, there is no reason, you know, there's no reason, you know? And but that's the, like, Locke keeps searching for that answer, for the why, for the, his faith is open. He's open to the universe in a way that Jack, with his bad father figure, is very closed off. And Jack, when you think of it that way, when you think about how closed off Jack is to opening himself up to the universe in that way, man of science, man of faith, Jack's anger makes a lot more sense in this episode. He is incredibly angry in a way that really, really, really does make sense to me. And Jeff explains it better, so I will let him. But I think that father figure stuff is very important. The Helen stuff, I don't know how extra important the Helen stuff is, but it's so enjoyable. Katie Sagal is so good as Helen. Katie Sagal from Married with Children, Sons of Anarchy, Futurama, like freaking legend of TV. Katie Sagal, it plays Helen, Locke's once girlfriend. We know from the season one that, you know, just sort of like as we knew before he said it from context clues from Jack, that Locke is no longer with Helen. He is talking to a phone sex worker and calling her Helen, which is very sad. You know what I mean? Because like it's not sad to talk to a phone sex worker necessarily, but it's sad to call that person by your ex. And you know, when I watch this episode, when I watch Helen and John like find each other, when I watch her like, when I watch them smooching and stuff like that, it's one of those flashback moments where you get so sad because you're like, here is someone who is, life is throwing them a lifeline right here, and they don't understand that that is what is happening to them right now. and we don't know yet what decisions Locke is going to make to bring him alone in a box factory in a chair, sad and angry. But, you know, watching someone happy in a flashback who then gets so sad, there is so much poignant tragedy to it. I love this flashback, and I do think it is tied thematically to the island stuff.
I guess it's not as easy as a one-to-one comparison to me, but I do think you're right that, like, the overall mood thing is there, and setting up, I think, even more importantly, what's to come is, like,
well, it's not
the stakes.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Well, and it's not just John's journey, because this episode, you know, the Pitt stuff aside, this is a Jack Locke journey, right? And so the flashback might just be Locke, but it needs to sort of be able to spread out to both of them. And, like, Locke is a person who occasionally has to grapple with his anger. Jack is a person who is always grappling with his anger. You know what I mean? And so this idea of exploring anger and why we're angry and therapeutically trying to work through our anger in the flashback, like, Jack should have been in that support group big time. And he has no coping skills when it comes to his anger. And you see that on the island stuff this week. So,
yeah, I like it. It sets the place for the two-man team that has to press the button going forward.
And
some of the issues are going to have to fix.
Quick question. So we're in agreement that Locke wins the argument this week, right?
I mean, I think he does.
Because Jack relents.
Jack presses the button.
Okay. I just think that's an interesting thing to keep track of, who's winning the argument.
Yeah. I mean, it does seem that that's, like, the risk of this episode, that the episode has to take you to. And that's the part that why it's in our season two theme at the top of the podcast, is Jack and Locke yelling at each other about believing in pressing a button mere seconds away from something that's either going to do nothing or blow up the entire world, depending on your belief in that moment. Is, like, such, from the outside, such a fragile, dramatic state. Like, I don't think you could drop somebody into that scene of Lost and have them think this is a remotely interesting show that is about anything related to the real world. But yet, it's, like, the point that this episode really shines and I think sets up some of my favorite discussions of Lost. These larger metaphorical discussions wrapped up inside daddy issues, which are relatable, wrapped up inside semi-relatable flashbacks, but then wrapped up in a greater unrelatable, you're in a hatch in a jungle because your plane crashed there, and maybe you have to press this button all the time. It's a good way of expanding into, I think, the type of show that Lost will eventually become without going super hard sci-fi right at the beginning. Even though, I mean, this is conceptual, but it's not like I mean, it's a lot less visually puzzling.
It's just
to me
electromagnetism, Dave.
Clouds. Well, it's not a black you know, thing that floats around and drags Locke under the ground. That's a lot more puzzling to me than there's an electromagnetic bomb or something underneath this computer.
Do they? So they say electromagnetism in this episode.
They do. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Good.
Dharma video, yeah.
Okay, Jeff said it in when he was talking to me, and I was like, I like made a little time code. I was like, is this weird? I can't remember. looking out for spoilers. It's never been easy, guys. What a great line. Anyway, what a great show this is.
What a great episode this is.
Yeah.
Do we run it? Like, we don't have to hop to the storm yet. I just want to get into some of our weekly questions, weekly things that we want to talk about.
Let's.
This feels like the time.
We have one clear winner of the Don't Fall Down Award, the Boone Carlisle Memorial Don't Fall Down Award. Belongs to Desmond, our pal.
Yep.
Which, another fun fact, this is one of those scenes, and I think there's actually several of these throughout Lost, where you can see a crew member as Desmond falls down in the background. So load up your Hulu after you're done. Rewind it. It's there.
Oh, yeah. I think we had one of those in Kate Falls Down with the liquor backpack.
Another crew member?
I think falling down is a precarious time to be in the background.
It usually happens either when someone's falling in the jungle or running through the jungle. Because the jungle trick that we talked about, that our emailer actually mentioned this week, I don't know if they continued to use that. That was just to save money and time on the pilot. Like, they may have actually run later in this season.
To carved out a piece of the jungle to be the running part.
Eventually,
of the
they made Evangeline Lilly also run in addition to climbing things.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, Kate again has had a very physical three episodes. Not only does she have the great, you know, Kate escape by slipping out of her.
What a Giacchino, of her cuffs. What a Giacchino-esque description of that.
Yeah. Now I just need to be good at composing soundtracks, I'm halfway there. And then, you know, she's gunning around and running to get Saeed on the beach.
There goes Kate gunning around again. Kate is capable. We love her. Giacchino Corner. The episode ends with a track which combines motifs for Jack and Locke with a theme of the swan. Swan is the name of the station, Swan Station. And it is called The Final Countdown, but it does not actually go... that's Giacchino Corner this week. Neil, do you want to bust out your Sawyer impression for this next part?
Ooh, yes, because it's time to get tied to a tree for our Jungle of Mystery moment. Wait, I had something else here, and somebody changed it. But actually, I think I agree with this one.
Yeah, I made an editorial decision.
Okay. So you'll never know what my pick was, but our pick is the missing pieces of film, which really was, I mean... If you're going to create two huge questions about the hatch, don't use the computer. And after the incident, we had to start pushing this button are two awesome ones to cut around if you're cutting pieces out of the film. The film was, I wouldn't recommend Googling it if you're calm only, but there were some fun threads on many a forum back in the day about what was in the film. And what was missing, and it was great.
It is pretty great. And then you have the whole Alvar Hanzo thing on top of it. But I think the most important thing is they're like, whatever you do with the computer, don't shoot it with a gun.
Right. Well, also,
and if they just would have had that little bit of film, they would have been aware.
I think what I love about this. This video too is it introduces a bunch of named characters who we now have to keep an eye out for those names. Like that's the thing that you have to do watching Lost going forward is like whenever they create a new named character, it's like, all right, well, I got to see if this dude's going to pop up or this person's going to pop up later. So,
Sorry. One more thing. If you're in the column, you're probably not going on Lostpedia, which is good. But this is also the episode where they start being like, here's what all the books on the shelf are, because that's about at the level the fandom was at, where it's right. Like Desmond touches this book and then this book before leaving the hatch.
It's Turn of the Screw, right?
Turn of the Screw is what the film's behind, uh-huh. But they also have, like, there's a book with a cross on it. There's a whole bunch of other spy related books. I think Rainbow Six is somewhere in there. Anyway, this is... Yeah, Easter eggs abound. Visual Easter eggs abound if you think they're important.
Turn of the Screw. Starting now. Turn of the Screw is about ghosts. So that's fun. One of our listeners, Jules, in the Slack, has said that she's going to do a weekly thing, and I'll just shamelessly steal from whatever she's found, where she's trying to dig up like an article or a theory that was like popular at the time.
Oh, yeah.
So something she dug up is that at the time... Damon Lindelof told E! Online that everyone should check out Marvin Candle's Left Hand. Weird, huh? And then this article is on today.com, and the writer says, we did and found that Candle's left arm and hand never moves throughout the entire orientation film. In fact, it looks a bit fake, like a bad prosthetic, or it could be one of those Twin Peaks things, I am the arm and such, though we sort of hope not. Ooh. And then,
oh my God, I wish it was still the universe of Twin Peaks. If the armor shot off, I'd be like, oh, I make this sound. Ooh. I would have been like, oh my God.
Remember Twin Peaks The Return and how good it was? We talked about that with Jeff Jensen, Twin Peaks The Return. So stay tuned. Anyway, also, I have something for the storm from this article. Don't read this article is what I'm saying if you're a commie. Anyway, yeah, so Marvin Candle's left hand, left arm.
Yeah, what's going on with that?
Ah, what's up with that? That's kind of a Jungle of Mystery moment, but it's encompassed in what we picked, which is... the film. We've been getting a lot of these really good Star Wars Lost mashup memes because our producer Diana is running this hashtag Lost on Star Wars meme contest that we will be giving out like a Star Wars prize to whichever Lost Star Wars meme we think is the best, since these are the two things that we are currently bumping up again in our coverage. And someone did a great one, which is John and Jack watching the film, and every time it cuts to the screen, it's just footage of Jar Jar from the prequel. It's just Jar Jar stuff, and it's not like it looks painstaking. I mean, the person must have taken so long to make this thing, and then it just ends with Locke going, "We're gonna need to watch that again."
Yes, more Jar Jar. It's a leap of faith, Jack.
Anyway, yes.
Excellent. All right, unless we have anything else for the calm, are we ready to jump to our interview with Jeff Jensen?
Did we miss anything? Yes, we did. We missed the Leslie Arce Memorial Ironic Statement Award. Goes to Jack Shepherd for saying, "It's just a button."
No, it's everything, Jack. Dub Jack.
It's one of those memorial ironic statements that you immediately know is wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, no, obviously it's not just a button, Jack.
Just a button. Sure.
Yeah, she was just your wife. Oh,
I married her. I love how Desmond is so concerned. Is she okay? That woman?
Desmond's such a good friend. He remembers that from like years ago or whatever.
Is she okay? That he's like, of man, yours that you were cheating at the time that I once met you. No, we can't leave the calm without talking about our Hurley moment of the week, right? Which is Hurley being like, "Thank God things are back to normal on the beach," and then Kate runs up and he's like, "Ah, fuck." poor Hurley. He just wants to play fetch with Vincent on the beach. That's it. So, you know.
He was doing so well.
Kate's all dewy and looking like great and actiony, and she's just like, "Saeed, we need your help." And Harley's like, "Ah, god damn it."
Yeah.
There's also
like 5 hours. 5 hours of not being terrified.
She comes running back with a much bigger gun than she left with.
We should also notice that some of our listeners were a little annoyed by the moment where Hurley's walking around the hatch and he sees the pantry and he's like, "Whoa," and they're like, "Oh, great. The fat guy is like, whoa, food." But like, I mean, I don't know. Kate shoved five candy bars in her last week. So I think anyone on the island is going to be like, "Whoa, food."
Yeah, these people, this is day 45 of eating only fish and fruit, basically. It doesn't matter who's walking by. They're going to be like, "What's going on here?"
Loss is occasionally hit and miss on how it treats Hurley. This is not, there are other offenses that I will fry them for. This is not, I think, one of them, but.
I feel like we'll be back to this topic soon.
Uh-huh. Yeah, there's also I could have been, I guess, a Jungle of Mystery moment that the episode very clearly has Jack ask Desmond where he gets his food and then never addresses it again.
Well, this episode has, and this is why one of the reasons why I love it, it has these layers of questions, like the what happened to John Locke to get him to end up in the wheelchair is a question that sort of permeates the flashback, even though it doesn't matter here. It's like, you're just like, it's surreal watching this guy being like, when does it happen? And it's the same.
When is this going to go horribly wrong? Does she stab him?
I want to put like maybe a recurring thing we should do is like bad dad check-in or whatever, right? Because like Anthony Cooper's really pulling ahead in the polls here.
The bad dad power rankings.
When he's like, I mean, I know like Brian's way up there, right? Bad stepdad.
So Anthony Cooper's number one because he stole John's kidney.
He stole John's kidney, but then this week he had the audacity to be like,
also get first, over it.
When you first drove by my house and thought it was funny, I'm like, oh, fuck you. Yeah. Hey,
you. Okay, so
I mean, I think bad dad check-in's gonna go to whomever's in that episode being a bad
right.
dad.
Yeah, because I would put it at let's see.
Christian Shepherd killed a pregnant woman last time we checked in with him. So
yeah, oh, that is like, pretty bad.
But like, does that affect Jack personally?
Oh, that's the metric we're doing it.
Also, Brian Porter was trying to give away Walt. He was trying to return Walt to the store.
Remember when Michael stole Brian Porter's dog?
Right. That's actually why Brian Porter's probably at the low end, because yeah. he also took a big L with the dog. So it was like, it's like, number one is Anthony Cooper. Two is Christian Shepherd because he's done some murder and like accidental murder. And three is, the guy who got his dog stolen who tried to return his child to Target.
Sawyer's dad killed Sawyer's mom. So, and himself.
Oh, Sawyer's dad. Yeah, that's a rough one.
It's a bad one. Yeah.
Well, but all his money got took. That's not really
Sawyer's
his fault.
Dad was at a pretty low point.
He killed his mom. He could have just had the decency to kill himself, but he killed Sawyer's all, mom.
All his money got took because the mom slept with the con man, is what we're implying here with the Sawyer thing.
I don't think you want to align yourself with Sawyer. Why are you defending Sawyer's dad in any context?
Oh, Sawyer's dad is like a three. He's not. I would still put him above Brian Porter.
Are you?
So that's, he's yeah. three. Brian's
fair, because
four.
Brian like did raise Walt okay until he. You know,
yeah, Brian didn't kill anyone
that we know of.
That we know of.
I would not put past Brian Porter. I'm just saying. All right, so we're gonna do Bad Dad check in. Probably weekly. This week, obviously, the king of Bad Dad.
It's just Anthony super Cooper. Easy to do the, all the time with this
the
show.
The defending champ. Anthony Cooper.
Right. Now it's just a question of can any father do something worse to their child than what Locke's father did to him?
Can anyone unseat Anthony Cooper? I have some possible contenders. We'll talk about them when they show up. But yeah. All right. So that's it. We did all the things.
It's just
all
a button.
Things. Then let's go to our interview with Jeff Jensen.
All right. We are thrilled to have on the Storm podcast Jeff Jensen, or as some people might know him, Doc Jensen, the preeminent Lost culture writer. Hi, Jeff. How are you?
Well, hi. How are you?
I'm good. We are having you on this episode orientation because I offered you sort of all of season two, laid it at your feet. And you said to me, and I quote, you said to me, the episode of Lost that officially made me gonzo fan of the show was episode 3 of season 2. So what is it about orientation that made you gonzo for Lost, Jeff Jensen?
Well, so many things. When I think about orientation, I think about that opening sweep of episodes that the season premiere, which I think is called Man of Science, Man of Faith. Am I right or wrong about that?
Oh,
or
you
am
nailed
I already
it.
Losing my Lost? No, good. Okay.
You nailed it.
And I love that episode. Then we move into Adrift, which is definitely a Adrift episode of Lost, one of the worst. But then Orientation, which it kind of completely rebounds. And this sort of triptych of episodes completely just like, I had been a fan of the first season and had written about it, but these three episodes taken together, and specifically the third, Orientation, just like made me crazy for the show. So Orientation specifically, of course, is we get our first big download of Dharma Initiative mythology, specifically in the form of that Orientation film. And, you know, when John Locke said the immortal words, we're going to have to watch that again. He spoke for me and I think for a lot of people. And I watched that thing over and over and over again in the weeks and months to come. this episode completely delighted and tantalized and hooked me for the part of the show. That's the puzzle. That's the mystery. That's what is happening. Why are these people been brought to the island? What is the history of the island? What is the purpose of the island? What is all of these things like? And what was the Dharma Initiative? And what were they studying? And what do they have to do with anything? And what about this mysteriously chopped up, edited film and filled with conspicuous touches, like from loaded names to the fact that Dr. Marvin Candle's arm doesn't move to the symbol of the Dharma logo itself. Like, I was just so tantalized by all of these details, and it just got that part of my brain that's always been part of my sort of geek fandom, the theorizing part of my brain, going.
Yeah.
And so this episode, like, just it launched a million theories from me and really created Doc Jensen, because out of that I told my editors I gotta be online theorizing about the show and playing with the show like every other fan. Like, you know, I was just that guy, like, internally at Entertainment Weekly. After every episode of Lost, I would just share my nutty theories via email with my colleagues, and and they actually encouraged me. You got to get online and play with people. So that's part one of that story. That's a huge reason why orientation spoke to me. The other part, and I'll talk to this, and then I'll shut up for a second, mm-hmm. which is that. Is that I've always was intrigued and I love the themes of faith and reason in the show, and orientation hits that really hard. And in the conflict between Locke and Jack, and in the internal conflicts within Locke and within Jack, I recognize myself as a guy who is a person of faith, but also kind of conflicted about my own faith, and is constantly questioning my own faith, or even wondering where it comes from. Like, is it grounded and rooted in something that is actually real? Am I seeing it clearly, or am I just kind of colored by my own biases and my own personal history and pains and traumas? Do I want this to be true? The conflict between these two guys, the conflict within themselves, the larger meta questions represented by the hatch, and how it pertains to all of that. It just, like, spoke to me rather powerfully, and building to one of my favorite moments on a character level in all of Lost, when Locke says to Jack, "Why do you find it so hard to believe?" And Jack says, "Why do you find it so easy?" And Locke just says rather poignantly, "It's never been easy."
Yeah.
You know, and I was like, oh, that exchange, those three lines delivered by the way that the way that those guys deliver those lines. That's like, I feel like that's my spiritual life in a nutshell. It's Lost presents themes of faith and reason so fancifully and in the abstract and metaphorically and emotional. It's a weird thing. It doesn't present necessarily a coherent view of all of those ideas, but somehow it expresses some truth about that in an emotional way. And I connected to that. So orientation is the show that made me a playful fan, but also kind of told me, oh, this is a show about deep things in me that I recognize. And so, it's the most meaningful episode of Lost to me. It may not be the best, empirically, in terms of quality,
sure.
But it's the one that means the most to me.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned your faith, because I had that down as a question to ask you. I know that about you, that you are a man of faith. I had that down, and then I was like, next to it, it says in parentheses, too personal, question mark. So I'm glad that you were like, no, I'll talk about that. But I, you know, I'm an agnostic, sort of like atheist leaning person. And I, like, I never necessarily connected to the spirituality of Lost when I first watched it. I think it wasn't until Damon sort of reexamined some of these themes in the later, you know, in The Leftovers, that I really started to connect with that, that questioning, that doubt, that he's so interested in his work. And then circling back and watching Lost through that lens, I find I'm connecting with those themes so much more this time. But I'm curious if you think that being a man of faith, being someone who has a sort of rich interior spiritual life, do you feel like that gives you an advantage over some other watchers in terms of connecting with what Lost is trying to do?
Well, I wouldn't say that I have a rich internal spiritual life. I would definitely say I have a tumultuous and conflicted and even confused spiritual life. And I would argue that that's what I found reflected in the show. You know, like it was a show that seemed to sort of like have a lot of empathy for really confused spiritual people like me. Even as I persist in faith of like, I feel like that there is something true about what I believe. It also kind of, and so the show affirms that part of me. Yeah. It also challenges me to interrogate that faith and kind of go, really? Like, why do you believe what you believe? Like, how can you be so certain? What if your faith is a product of anything from just confused intellectual thinking to, you know, wish fulfillment fantasy to past trauma, all of that? I appreciated Lost challenging me, but also kind of saying, I'm with you. Like, I empathize with that too, you know? That said, I would just want to clarify that part of it. Does that give an advantage? I've always said about Lost that, it's such a rich and complicated show, and you can enjoy it on so many different levels for so many different reasons and think it's the greatest thing ever, right?
Right.
The two things that I kind of identified, the theorizing puzzle part of the show, the mystery part of the show, and the issues of faith in the show, like, those are two of many reasons why people can love the show and be so like so wild about the show. And I know a lot of other fans who, like, for whom it's just like, oh, like that was an interesting theme, or, oh, I didn't go in for theorizing at all. I just love the amazing adventure of all of this stuff. And these finely drawn characters and the spectacular storytelling. I mean, that alone is worth watching the show. So, like, the fact that I connected with those two areas of the show that, you know, obviously the issues of spirituality were very important to the creators of the show, and certainly the show played to the part of the audience that wanted to play with the show as a kind of puzzle. That certainly, like, helped my personal appreciation of the show, but I'm reluctant to compare and contrast different kinds of fans or say that one mode or relationship to Lost is puts you in a better position to like the show or makes you a different or better kind of fan. Like, this show meant so much to so many people for so many different reasons, and that's one of the things that is so beautiful about it, that it could have such an, you know, inspire such a diverse fan base and a eclectic set of interest in it, you know.
Absolutely. No, I definitely wasn't trying to angle for like, does that make you a better fan? But I am.
No, for sure.
I do want to circle back to this, this theme of faith with, which I think is so, and doubt, which I think are so interesting in this episode. And you mentioned, of course, that great exchange between, Jack and Locke, but there's also this moment when Locke is talking to his father, and he's asking him why, you know, I just want to know why you did this to me. And for that, it really drove home something that I wasn't connecting super well, which is the issue with fathers in this show, which, you know, of course, Damon and everyone has talked about in terms of loss. So like the issues of fathers, but then the, you know, blurring that line of like, daddy issues, if you want to put it that way, and God issues, you know what I mean? To sort of like that doubt, that faith, that thing that we look for in a father, that we look for in a God figure, and we look for in the island, you know, and whatever it might be that is this guiding hand. And I don't know if you have any thoughts about the intermingling of those ideas.
Yeah, I mean, the why of it all, like that beautiful moment, that painful moment that Locke has in the car with his dad. Like, why did you do this to me? You know, like that question haunts all of Lost, you know, like, why is this happening to me? Why are you doing this to me? And that question is so resonant in all of us in so many ways. Even as someone, again, that just kind of like for me, that's where, like, forgive me if I'm taking your question in a different way, the why speaks to both of my interests in the show, right? The puzzle part of me that wants to figure the thing out, and the faith part of me that likes the show as sort of like an expression of tumultuous spiritual belief. I just feel for me, the thing that I often struggle with in my own life is like, when do I stop trying to figure things out? And when do I just trust? When do I hang on? And when do I let go? When do I stop asking why, to the impossible questions of existence that can't be explained, you know, like, and I just, I feel like it's amazing how this show kind of like pursues that idea in so many different ways, getting out of the cosmic for a second, but just in the emotional and in the personal, like why do relationships fail? Why did this person do this to me? Why am I the way that I am? Like, these are great questions that deserve answers that we obsess over, that we should interrogate. But at the same time, like, there is a point in which some of these questions, some of these mysteries of self, of our past, of pain, of our own identity, can't be answered. And so when do we learn then to let go of that interrogation and just to, you know, live out our lives or choose to be who we want to be and live that out? That tension, that paradox between constantly questioning, and then at one point do you stop questioning and just kind of live out your life in trust and faith, like of who you are, who you want to be, like it's I just love all of that about Lost and how it's all complicated that way.
Absolutely. All right, so let me rewind, press rewind, watch it again a little bit on this time in your interaction with the show. Just before season two, the big question, of course, was what's in the hatch. Do you remember any theories that you had about what was in the hatch that did not wind up being a Scotsman pressing a button every 108 minutes? Do you remember any of your hatch theories?
Yeah. What was I thinking going into the show? What was in there? What was inside the hatch? I don't know.
Okay.
I really forget what I might have been thinking about what was inside the hatch. I think most of my conjectures, if I had anything really thought out by that time, was kind of linked to any sort of speculation as to what the monster was. And because, you know, in season one, what little we saw of the monster seemed to suggest that it was subterranean. Mm-hmm. And that it might be linked to something mechanical. So I think that the idea of a hatch embedded in the earth and the fact that the monster, at least in season one, was presenting is probably something manufactured and possibly mechanical. I think that most of my kind of like general theorizing at that point was that the island, that there was, an elaborate machine works underneath the island, and the hatch represented some kind of like portal into the mechanisms of the island. And so that's what I kind of thought would maybe happen once they descended down into the hatch, that it would certainly lead to tunnels that would lead to other parts of the hatch island. And maybe even different communities on the island of something. I think that was my broader sense of my broader kind of like general theorizings. Like my very specific theorizings about Lost really didn't begin until what we actually saw, like in the hatch. I never once considered, And this is kind of an important thing to, you know, I've reflected on. I never once considered that there was a person living in the hatch, you know? Mm-hmm. And I've often like wondered why I never thought of that. And if that says something positive or negative about me, because, you know, it's interesting. One of the rules of Lost that became apparent to us by the end of the show and is a rule of Damon Lindelof's storytelling and the storytelling of everyone in the Lost writer room is that the best answer to a Lost mystery is a person. It's not an idea. It's not a thing. It's not some ancient piece of history. It's a character. It's a person. Mm. It's someone whom we can talk to or contend with or grapple with or have conflict with. It's a person. So and I think that that's an amazing rule, at least on the level of storytelling. And I think it's a great rule for Lost, because I think that regardless of what you think of what comes after these three episodes, and regardless of what you think of how they resolve the Dharma Initiative mythology, I really do think that those three episodes and the introduction of the character of Desmond was just incredibly delightful. And in fact, I think that one of the questions you asked me before I kind of went on this long answer was maybe some things that I noticed like watching it again in preparation for this. And like one of the things I connected to rather powerfully was just that sense of utter delight in the living mystery of Desmond, you know, of Desmond.
Yeah.
You know, like, who is this guy? Like, you know, like how did he get here? His whole like his own sort of like confusion and bafflement and befuddlement about his own predicament. And just the attitudes and the way that he holds himself in these first three episodes, like and the first time that we're hearing his catchphrase, "See you in another life, brother," I just remembered like how much that like completely captured my imagination. What, you know, like, it's possible that back in the day, people might have had mixed opinions about what that show, how that show resolved the question of what's in the hatch. But for me, they knocked the cover off the ball. Like, I was just all in on how they resolved all that.
I completely agree with you. I love that idea that the best answer to a mystery is a person or a character or something messy and human that we have to grapple with. I really love that.
Right.
You mentioned sort of, I don't know, you never thought it might be a person. And, I have covered certain shows in depth, certain shows that, you know, are begging me to theorize. I have chased incorrect rabbits down incorrect holes, theorizing. And I'm curious. I mean, you know, you don't have to like tell us incorrect theories you had, but I'm curious, what is a rabbit that you chased down the wrong hole in theorizing about Lost that you don't regret chasing because you learned a lot about something or you just enjoyed the ride and it didn't matter that it didn't pan out?
Every single one. I mean, that's the yeah. one thing, that's the one thing that like I've tried to talk about for years in terms of my own obsessive theorizing about the show. And I think that this is important to be in being a Lost fan. Now I'm going to be rather strident to the point of maybe being offensive to people. But what I would say is like, there is no right way to be a Lost fan, but there is at least one wrong way mm-hmm. to be a Lost fan. And that way is to sort of have a theory and now watching it to be proven right, you know?
Yep.
So if you were watching Lost because you had this idea of what it all means and how it's all going to add up, and you were waiting around to see if you were right, like I feel bad for you because like unless you are right, there's only one way you could possibly enjoy the show, which is to be right. And most likely, you know, we were all wrong. I remember at one point when during the Doc Jensen days, and I would get reader mail, and I remember getting into it one time with a fan who was a theorizer, and he had maybe a couple different theories, but there were a couple that he held on to passionately.
Right.
And I'm not trying to hide his name because I really forget his name now. I was like, I remember talking to him. I was like, you know what? Like, I don't think being right about this is what it's really about, you know? Mm-hmm. And he was like, oh, but Jeff, like, can't you imagine, like, you know, at the end of Lost and Oprah Winfrey has the entire cast and the writers on the show of Lost, on her show to celebrate the series finale. Cause she used to do that. Remember on her show, the Oprah Winfrey show,
yeah.
She would have like casts of like Friends or whatever, like on toward the ends of their runs. So, he was like, imagine that she's going to do that for Lost. And in that final episode, like they'll invite the one or two or three fans who got it right.
Wow.
And they celebrate those fans like in the show. And I'm like, are you kidding?
But
like, really? That's what we're playing for here?
Wow.
Like to be on the Oprah Winfrey show?
Yeah.
Like, and I just never really related to it that way. Like,
yeah.
I just loved like the stimulation of every episode and the stuff that it got me thinking about and the rabbit holes it would send me down. I loved that exploration. I never wanted one single theory of Lost. I like every week was about building a new theory and then throwing it away and saying, okay, like next week, like, give me something new to chase and let me think about it in a different way. Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. Lost is like this diamond with all of these different facets. And I just like rolling it around in my hand and looking at all, using the theories to look at the show in a lot of different ways. That's for me when the theorizing was the most fun, which was, it would give me kind of a new angle to chase. And it would lead me to a crazy collection of thoughts that it would allow me to appreciate the show in a different way. I think that to be, for me, my Lost fandom was ultimately, I liked playing with the show.
Yeah.
And I like to sort of like think about the show in a lot of different ways and theorizing about it in a lot of different ways. But at the same time, recognizing and submitting to the fact that this is a show being written by a group of writers who are telling us a story and they are following their own muse to some final destination. And you got to like it for that reason too, you know? Yeah. So I never, as weird and wacky as I could be with my theories, as if to suggest, here's how I'm looking at the show. Like, I felt like I could be that guy and have fun that way while also kind of just like appreciating the show for being the story that it was.
So as someone who, I covered Game of Thrones for years and it was on, and that means that wherever I went, oftentimes, when people found out that that's what I did, they would ask me questions about Game of Thrones. So I'm curious, since you were the Lost guy, I was a Game of Thrones person, you were the Lost guy. And so I'm just wondering, what was the weirdest place or moment in your life where someone tried to talk to you about Lost and you were like, really, here? Okay. You know, like, did that happen to you?
there were no weird places for me to ever talk about Lost, because no matter where I was from 2005, roughly, when my Lost obsession took off, to 2010, I was always talking about Lost. So for everyone in my life, whether they knew me or not, I was the weird place, you know, like in the sense of like to encounter me in any situation was to enter my kind of obsessed, warped, thing of Lost. It's hard for me to I don't really have a great, even funny answer to that question, because I really did enjoy talking about Lost, and to a degree that, like, I think a lot of some people at that time in my life were like, I'm a little concerned about you, Jeff. And I was just like, come on, you know, I'm just having fun. And now I look back on it, and for any number of reasons, which I've written about in the past, no, they were right. Like, I was really all in on that show for fun reasons, but very personal and difficult reasons. I've written about this in the past before, so I hope I don't, you know, mind me saying it again, but, you know, during this period of time, my wife, was struggling with a serious illness with cancer. And so that was a very difficult time in our family. And, Lost became, for better and worse, given the themes that the show was dealing with, it felt like it was, to use a spiritual word, ministering to me in the sense of my own confusions about that situation. But it was also an escape from that situation, both in good ways. And I look back on it now and would I trade every moment that I was on Wikipedia, like researching Turn of the Screw, for another moment with my wife? Yes. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, at that time in my life, it was like it was unneeded. That was my distraction. Boy, I kind of took your fun question in a really kind of tough place. No. But that was lost for me in that period of time. There was, you know, I did enjoy the role of lost answer man. I did enjoy every single conversation with every fan who was equally engaged with the show. I don't recall any awkward or like, why are you talking about Lost here on a plane or here in the middle of the street or whatever. Like I never really have any of those stories. I was the guy that you're listening to now and your viewers are your listeners are listening to now, the guy who just goes on and on and on about Lost.
Well, no, that's exactly why we love you. I want to ask you, there's something going on with Jack in this episode. This is related to the answer you just gave me, but there's something going on with Jack in this episode that I connected to this time in a way I haven't before, which is an anger, and Jack is often angry, but there is an anger in this episode that even though I can't quite put my finger on why Jack is so angry in this episode, I connected to his anger. And so, and I don't know if that's just like living in Trump's America has put me in a place or something like that where I'm like, yeah, get angry. But like, for you, I don't know, like if you have any thoughts about Jack's anger, either specifically in this episode or in the series overall, that you either connect with or don't.
You know, in this episode, it's interesting. Kind of coming to this episode, I feel like that Jack is an interesting character for me and a tough character for me in that in order for me to really appreciate Jack, I feel like I have to take the whole journey with Jack. So like in terms of preparing for this episode, for this conversation today, I watched Orientation out of context of Lost for the first time in like, you know, several years. And Locke's story was easy for me to drop into. Desmond's story was easy to drop into. And of course, Hurley and even Saeed's story was just easy for me to kind of like, you know, like connect with those. Jack's intensity, Jack's issues are such that for me, I kind of feel like I need a bigger reboot on Jack in order to really connect with that. That said, the thing about Jack, like, which I accept at face value in this episode is, you know, obviously they're an incredibly stressful situation, given the events that have led up to this moment in this season. This idea that he is profoundly rattled by Desmond, he knows who Desmond is, you know, he remembers this past relationship with Desmond. Jack is a guy who just needs to believe so much in his own self-sufficiency and himself that he is enough to be the hero of his life, and to conquer or master any situation. He's a superhero personality. He is always in control. He has to be in control. If he's not in control, he's worried that he will self-destruct. And he's worried about what he will do if he feels out of control, because ultimately he's also an addict personality.
Right.
And he's never really, I think, properly addressed that part of himself either. He's trying to save himself and cure himself through his own just like, you know, belief in his own Superman nature. So anything that comes along that subverts that sense of self, things that, like, you know, are beyond his powers of control or outside his understanding, is such a profound threat to all of that. So to encounter this total coincidence that can't be a coincidence, of this man that I encountered once long ago in a pivotal point in my life, and he's here, he's in this hatch on this island. How can that be? Well, the only thing that can maybe explain that possibly is that there is a greater design to my life that I'm not seeing, that I'm being manipulated by forces, that I am not really in control of my own destiny.
Right.
And I think that idea just like it just touches on all of the wounded parts of Jack, you know, and that agitates him. And when he gets that way, he just gets intense. He gets angry. He gets out of control. And that's sort of like the Jack that we're seeing here. So that's how I'm kind of making sense of him in this moment. The mystery of Desmond and the parts of that touches on, just his own sense of like agency, but also the very specific wounded parts of reminding him of his, you know, failed relationship, with his wife, relationship that maybe he should never have been in the first place. And then the possibility that this crazy lock guy might be right, like, which just kind of like gets under his skin. Like, that's kind of how I'm reconciling all of that. It's just touching on those wounded parts of Jack that he is trying to heal by just believing that he is enough, that he's in total control, that he doesn't need people, that he doesn't need God. He doesn't need his dad.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that he is enough, you know?
I love that idea that, like, both, you know, this is the fundamental idea of Lost, right? Or a fundamental idea. Both Locke and Jack are presented with these bad father figures, these father figures who leave them wounded or abandoned or are unreliable or downright destructive, right? And if you extrapolate that to a godlike figure, right, you can. And then what is your reaction to that? Is your reaction exactly what you're saying with Jack, which is you become a clenched fist and you're just curled in on yourself and
yes.
You're just like, it's just me then. Got it. I got this. Fine. Or do you somehow become a Locke and still keep searching for those larger answers, those larger forces? I love this idea that Desmond threatens that clenched fist for Jack. And he's like, no, I will not open it up to this, to the mysteries of the universe. I think that's great.
Right.
All right.
Yeah.
So my last question for you, and thank you so much for your time. This is such a pleasure for me to talk to you about this, is, you know, in your relationship with the show, and in writing, so, you know, becoming the lost guy, you then, like, you know, sort of got the dream that people who get so involved in another creator's work, in that you've gone on to work with Damon on Tomorrowland and on Watchmen a bit. And I was just wondering if you know, I don't know how much you can say about whatever, but I was so excited. I'm excited every week to see your name in the credits for Watchmen. And I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about what that's like to sort of flip to the other side of collaborating with a creative mind that you've spent so long studying.
Yeah, you know, I have so I'll tell you a story as a way to help answer that question.
Perfect.
The very first time I ever talked to Damon, it was an interview in the fall of 2004. So I was a writer at Entertainment Weekly. I was writing about both movies and TV. I was becoming increasingly interested in all things J.J. Abrams, Bad Robot, and I was all in on Lost. And whenever Dan Sneerson, my good friend Dan Sneerson, my partner in Totally Lost, whenever he wasn't writing about Lost, I would come in and write something else. And so in the fall of 2004, I was assigned to write this like 150 word box in the TV section of Entertainment Weekly about the use of quote unquote Easter eggs in the storytelling of Lost. And so I called up ABC and said, hey, can I interview J.J. Abrams? And they said, well, you know, J.J. is like a really important person, and he doesn't really have a lot of time to do interviews, especially for a 150-word box in Entertainment Weekly. But would you talk to Damon? Because he's like equally involved in running the show, and he's a co-author of the show, and he's really important. And I'm like, fine, I'll talk to Damon, whoever this guy is, right?
Yeah.
And so, so they put him on the phone, and he's like, hi, and like, you know, introduces himself, and we have some, you know, chit chat. And the first thing he asks me is, what else are you working on other than this 150-word box? You must be doing other things at Entertainment Weekly, right? And I was like, well, yeah. In fact, I'm writing and reporting an oral history of the creation of the greatest graphic novel, really comic book series ever made. And he goes, Watchmen? And I'm like, yeah.
Wow.
And I'm like, you know, because I did not assume that this guy knew anything about comics. So I wasn't going to say Watchmen. I just say comic. He was like, Watchmen. He goes, like, yeah. And I was like, you know Watchmen? And he was like, oh my gosh, like Watchmen, like we're talking about Easter eggs, and like where do you think I learned Easter eggs from, you know? And then like this led to this conversation that stretched what was supposed to be a 15-minute phoner. Now the first half an hour to 45 minutes, with tape rolling, by the way,
yeah,
is like all about our obsession with Watchmen. And so it's interesting then that, you know, 15 years later, through, you know, getting to know him while reporting out Lost, after Lost was over, kind of saying, I'm not going to write about you anymore. Let's be friends. And so like we develop a friendship, and then we work on Tomorrowland together. And then now like in this new adventure, you know, when he decided to do Watchmen as a television show, he invited me to come along for this weird ride. And it feels like our whole rapport comes full circle, and in trying to sort of tackle the problem of, around this sort of thing that we love, that inspired so much of our imagination growing up, and trying to conquer the problem of how do you tell a Watchmen story as a television show. And to be now on the inside of working on a television show created by a guy whose television storytelling I've admired for a long time, has been a thrill. It's been fun. It's been exciting. It's been challenging. It's been difficult. But it's been great. And it's funny, because to bring it full circle with the episode that we're telling about, and to kind of maybe, you know, dead end us into a small point, but you know, one, you know, it's funny watching, this episode of Lost through the eyes of being a Damon collaborator and listening to his stories about, the stories that he's told in the past on television, the lessons that he's learned, and the rules that he's adopted as a result of them. And there is a certain, you know, this episode of Lost, you know, a big part of the problem of this episode of Lost occurs when a gunshot goes off and hits the computer, and they have to spend the entire episode fixing the computer. And it was fun to learn, for example, that in the writer's room of Lost after this episode, whenever they would get into storytelling jams, if you will, where they knew that they needed a kind of plot that kind of represented, you know, maybe manufacturing a conflict for the sake of creating a story, before they get to the one big thing that needs to happen in that episode, they called it the shot computer plot, you know? and so the idea, and I learned this lesson like while I could be getting that story a little wrong. Like, we'll watch Damon call you up and wanting to do an emergency podcast to clarify this story. But like, but the idea that I've heard the phrase, you know, it's a shot computer a lot in the writer's room of Watchmen. And, you know, usually cause you know, the thing about Watchmen is that every episode is so dense and is a story itself. There is no room or time for shot computer plots. So whenever, you know, like I would pitch a bad idea or an idea that he didn't want to go do, he would often say, that's a shot computer plot. And so, but it was funny then watching this episode and encountering the shot computer and learning and experiencing the origin of this phrase that he used often in the room.
Yeah, that's really funny. We were just watching a later season episode I'm watching with my roommate, and she's never seen the later seasons, and the later season is just very, she was like, remember when they spent, you know, half a season trying to get into the hatch? And it's like, yeah, later seasons of Lost is a similar thing. There's no time for a shot computer plot in a later season of Lost, right? You're just like going, you know, sort of thing. So that's funny. What a great little bit of, you'll hear, you know, you listeners will hear me say shot computer plot again and again as we go through, I will do that.
One other interesting thing that I really noticed about orientation watching it again, and that I think that I was in touch with when I saw it the first time, you know, when I was watching season two, when it first aired with the rest of us, is that orientation really is also an episode in which Lost is talking to its fandom about the struggle and frustration of being a Lost fan. You know, it is a very self-aware episode about the demands that it's placing on the audience, but it's in the sense of like, this is, you know, we are a broadcast television show. It is our job to remain a successful broadcast television show, which means that all of these mysteries that you want answered, all of this, the plot tension, will these guys get rescued? Where are they? All of these things now are like, we don't know when we're going to resolve all of this stuff. And because we don't know if we can end the show. And what we know behind the scenes is that as early as the beginning of season two, Damon Carlton and JJ knew that they had an issue of, like the only way that the best possible form of Lost is probably a 48 episode show. And that we're not going to be able to really resolve all of these things that people want answers to or resolution to, until we know we can end. And until then, like, you know, a lot of it is going to have to be shot computer plots. You know, a lot of it is going to have to be like, you know, adrift on an ocean with Sawyer and Michael on a log, you know,
right.
A lot of it is going to be like, you know, Sawyer, Jin, and Michael trapped in a cage, trapped in that little pit, you know? And that for the Lost fan, then it's an act of faith. It's a leap of faith that like all of this means something. All of this is going to add up to something. And that until then, it is an exercise in like watching a choppy orientation film and having faith that it means something.
Right.
It does represent just like sitting at a computer and dutifully inputting a code every 108 minutes as you in the same way that you show up here every week to watch 60 minutes of Lost. And so in many and various ways, orientation is about setting an orientation for Lost fandom. And it's an episode that says, like, we feel your pain, you know, we get it, you know, like this, our job is to keep you constantly entertained and constantly enmeshed with this show. But at the same time, we understand that it's a leap of faith for you and we're kind of grateful for it, you know? So, that's another thing that really kind of struck me about orientation.
Yeah. I hadn't thought about it that way. It's an excellent point. Balancing the large mysteries with the network demands of like action of how do we get out of this? How are we going to get out of the pit this time, folks? Stay tuned for stuff. So,
that's right. Right.
Oh, Michelle Rodriguez is here. Okay. So, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah.
excellent. Well, thank you. Thank you for that addendum. That was fantastic. And thank you also for your time. I really do appreciate it.
Cool. Yeah. Thanks for asking me on.
All right. We're crawling out of the pit, crawling out of the hatch to thank our friends and Patreon subscribers. You too can be part of our small council. You get to watch movies with us. You get to, they're doing a gift exchange again this year, the second annual Storm Podcast gift exchange. So if you're part
that's just because they're great people. We don't organize that.
You gotta be in the small council. They do it. You just gotta be in the small council to do it with them. And it's really fun. They like give each other fun gifts and it's not like, you know, it's fun. We have fun. All right. So we want to thank these small council members, including a bunch of newbies. We got Chelsea Doyle, Mark Larson, Devin, Michelle Cahill, Ben Grieving, Grace Brown, Christopher Vanjonic, Gabriel Colorado, Matt Turrell, LM, Marcus Holdgrave, Amy Thompson, Dean, Laura Anderson, Jeff Ruberg, Laura Achu, Benjamin Jacoby, Reginator Cakes, Elise Abschutz, and Gustavo Villarreal. Thank you guys so much.
I too have a list of folks that we would like to thank, starting with DJ Empirical. We also have Aubrey Iyer, Phil Jackie, Jessica Lair, Svabir Sigfason, I think that's right, Manu Mishra, Megan McLeod, David Koplos, Eve Fontelet, Ryan Silverstein, Lily Lim, Derek Dock, Vince Luis, Russell Griffin, Philip Durrett, Melanie Rodriguez, Sarah Carmichael, Spencer Howard, Wong Lee, and Michael Sample. Thank you all.
Oh, that was just thank you all. And
yep, that was it. Sorry.
In the meme. Okay, good. All right. I also have a list of people who thank that are small council members. Thank you. Jenna Mandel, Chris Ernst, Rosa Peretta, Ashish Sridharan, Kayla Sargent, Annie AK, Stephanie Breitbach, Becky McMorrow, Matt Campbell, Bronwyn Beck, Aaron, Jillian, Q Johnson Arnold, Jeremy M. Johnson, Joe Torrens Fernandez, Paul, Asaya Glover, Kelly Edison, Tay, Kelsey Almaguer, and Jennifer Barrett. Thank you guys so much for being part of the small council.
I think my favorite part is when you get through a hard one and then you screw up an easy one next.
Yeah.
Because it's like, damn, I just got through the hard one. Oh, shit.
I'm unstoppable.
I feel like I do that too.
Peter, damn it. And we're back in the storm for another week. This week we have Hatch Film, but more importantly, we are back with a lock antagonist check-in that actually means something. We begin pressing the button, and this is ultimately an exercise in character, you know, exploration, and not so much an exercise in mythology, because at the end of this, you know, the hatch is going to implode, I think, one way or the other. The world doesn't actually end.
Okay, can we go back to this today.com article that Jules...
Yes.
Oh, let us.
Hmm. E also hints a female character will be killed off soon, just saying.
What?
What?
Which one? Like
Shannon. They,
okay. See, the funny thing
Shannon.
Is Oh, yeah.
I think you know, you can see it. You can see it at the time, everybody thinking that it's going to be, well, I guess your initial reaction would be what, Kate, and then be like, "Nah, they wouldn't kill Kate." So then it's like, "Oh, well, Anna Lucia, she may not last long." Yeah, I think that's why the Shannon thing sort of comes out of left field, because, you know, I don't think anybody expected it to be Shannon.
Wow. Yeah, no, I forgot it was Shannon, because at this point they still haven't cast Livy or Bernard, because they don't appear earlier in the episode.
Yeah, they're coming up,
though. Conveniently shot around. Yeah, I mean, they know they have to have them, but they aren't the actors yet. And the thing I was referring to is they edit a picture of Penny in that Jack sees.
Right, because it's originally aired with a different actress. Because they don't cast, right. Penny doesn't actually show up until like the finale of this season. Right?
Yeah, or season three. Is it the finale of the season?
Or season three. It's whatever what is it? Live Together, Die Alone, part one.
Oh, I think that's the finale.
Finale.
Of this one.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so good. That's when we come back to Desmond being written back into the show, because he comes back with the magical.
That's when we find out about Kelvin as well. That's when Kelvin shows up. That's the flashback. Yeah.
Isn't the best part of that, are you talking about the Desmond and Penny photo?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't the best part of that photo the fact that it was like taken in front of a backdrop, like a paper backdrop, that he's not actually in a marina? No.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because it's.
I love that. That's one of my favorite things that Locke ever done. Is you're like, one thing I know for sure, Desmond and Penny once stood in front of a marina.
And no, and like, it's just like some market.
Yeah. Or it was just a paper backdrop. Anyway.
They were never in the movie.
It's a really great retcon later.
Yeah. How are we going to get them in front of the marina? What if we don't? Anyway.
What if there was no marina the whole time? Ooh.
Yeah. Now that we're on the other side of it, I think I feel more comfortable saying that the shoot the computer idea is like a problem of the week, basically, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that later, and it's a good one, right? There's literally a ticking clock. Kate has to get Saeed. Saeed has to figure out how to fix a thing. Hurley has to follow the conduits, and apparently has never seen Jurassic Park, so he doesn't know what they are, you know, like all this sort of stuff. But
Hurley almost gives John the wrong number.
It's true. But the later on in Lost will not have room for it. That feels like a very network kind of thing, right? And what Jeff
describes, problem of the week, monster of the week.
Right. What Jeff describes is that in the Watchmen writer's room, when they were talking about ideas, like if Damon was going to shoot something down, he would say that's a shoot the computer plot. And like, basically, we don't want to do those stories on this show. And Lost later on does not have room for shoot the computer plots. Barely any shoot the computer plots in later seasons, like the last 2.5 seasons of Lost. So I think that's fun. It's a fun little shorthand that we got from this episode of Lost.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and then they also like these three episodes are all like those mini things just stacked on top of each other. It's kind of amazing to think about when Hurley comes back in this episode and is like, oh, I'm glad that like baby stealing thing didn't happen. That is like what most of them are thinking about, because we've spent so much time in this moment where like getting the people on the raft back on the island, and now they're in a pit, and then like the hatch thing's happening, and now we have the computer.
And we had to watch the hatch thing from three different angles.
Uh-huh.
Over the course of just several weeks.
We exactly know what's happening and all the questions before, you know, we get trapped down there for stuff like lockdown and stuff. But I really, this is like apex of mystery, because we start getting like weird answers to some of these questions, and some are less satisfying than not. But in mystery box fashion, Orientation might be one of my favorite, if not my favorite episode of season 2. just like, oh, everything's bursting at the seams. But then, you know, now we get to talk about if Walt gets to live in that computer along
with Walt!
Other things.
Definitely don't use the computer to communicate with Walt.
It's funny. I have never considered this to be like even a top episode of Lost, but hearing all of you guys talk about it, I think it probably is. I just never thought of it that way. And I think it's because I thought of this episode as just so concerned with mystery, and that's not necessarily my top thing about Lost that I love, but it is so much about character too. It's both. The other thing mm-hmm. that Jeff said that just like blew my mind is that I can't remember if he said it was like an actual thing that Damon has articulated or just something that I think it is something that Damon Lindelof articulated, which is the best answer to a mystery. Oh, brace yourself. Like, hold on to something. Listeners have already heard this because they already heard the interview, but the best answer to a mystery is a person. And that will be useful in watching Watchmen as well. But in watching the best answer to what's in the hatch is Desmond. Hume is in the hatch, you know. And
then he's running away from the hatch.
And then it's like so then it like blends the two things, you know, like what's in the hatch, it's a human and a messy human with complicated human emotions. And like, he's going to have his own very like emotional story that we're going to get caught up in on the show. And that's like, that's the blend of like the two things that Lost us.
And then we're going to need to know what the hell happened to Kelvin.
Oh, but I don't care.
No one cares. Sorry, Kelvin. No, that's one of the things I love about this. This really is like, you spend the whole first season of Lost learning that there is a mystery box. And then three episodes into season two, someone comes by and just like kicks the mystery box over real quick. And it's like, oh shit, look at all these things that just flew out of this box. Like, what is the Dharma Initiative? Who are these guys? Who's that Hanso guy? That guy's crazy. Also, who's the family that he mentions at the end?
DeGroots?
The DeGroots? What's their fucking deal?
What's that? Yeah.
Helen's in this. And, you know, obviously we want to know more about Helen, from season one. And, yeah. It's, you know, and I think that there are also like other underlying questions that permeate this episode. Like, how are they now that they have the hatch? What does that mean? What are they going to do with all the food? And they only have like 40 people. Like all of these, and you know, they spend season two answering these questions. But if you think about it, they have to kind of spend the rest of season two unpacking this episode, which shows how sort of important this episode is, I think.
Yeah. And it's kind of amazing that they hold the button pressing tension for an entire season. It's still, to me, one of I think I said this at the beginning of season two, but like one of the most interesting ideas of like pre-planning a season of television and then executing it.
Are you ready for my favorite moment of any episode of the Storm podcast?
Sure.
It's time for Locke protagonist chicken.
Oh, okay.
Locke is a protagonist, especially in this episode, right? This episode does.
Unless you are Jack.
Well, this episode does underline sort of like what, you know, Dave argued when he argued something that finally made sense to me, which is Locke at odds with Locke's intentions at odd with Jack's intentions make him as an antagonist. But like, is Jack right? I mean, I think we can feel pretty confident that he's largely not.
On this specific thing, he is wrong, obviously, because something does happen when they don't press the button.
Well, not only that, but Jack made it happen back in time.
So yeah, he should have known.
It is. Well, I mean, it's definitely his burden to bear, at least in this episode.
Cosmically.
Interesting.
Well, yeah, and I think this episode does a good, and this is maybe the strongest argument for why the flashback works, because this episode does a lot of work to make you feel empathy for John. In seeing his frustration, you're also kind of angry with him because he's being a real dick at the beginning. But then it sort of unwraps the reasons why he's so frustrated and so angry. And that paired with this argument that he's having with Jack and the fact that Jack is just losing it over this. I think it makes John the not necessarily not just the protagonist, but he is the sort of truth teller of this episode, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and oh, he plays well. That role very well when he needs mm-hmm. to.
I think we're on his side because we have the flashback to pair it to, but I'm not sure, like, if you're down in that hatch, you're Saeed or Kate or Hurley. Why is this guy making this big deal about this first button push? Why does it have to be Jack this first time? Why does John Locke need Jack to, you know, sacrifice his pound of psychic flesh, like right now in such a dramatic fashion?
It's because Desmond recognized him. I think that's what throws John into this, like, I need to escalate this. And it's funny because that's something they actually changed from the last episode, because in, what is it? Like, when he first sees Desmond, Jack's the one who says you.
Yeah, that's the,
and in this episode, Desmond's the one that recognizes Jack.
In the face.
So yeah, so when I think that's the moment, like, when Desmond recognizes Jack, Locke knows that he's got him in a weird, like, faith pickle. So he's like, I got him. He can't just weasel his way out of this, because he can't just be like, the universe is random. Then why the hell does that guy know who you are?
Does that sound like the act of a protagonist to you?
Yes. he's right.
Well, he's right. So he's right.
Also,
he's not right. They don't need to press the button.
Well, if they don't press the button in that moment, they would be in trouble. Well, kind of.
That's true, because they didn't run, but everybody on the beach would have been fine.
Yeah, I mean, everybody survives the hatch blowing up, but
except Desmond's
clothes. So who knows? They're just not ready to all be naked.
We got too far away from it, but
right.
I just need to say that I'm calling Weird Faith Pickle as the band name. My band name. I called it. You can't have it.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, you can tell that's the moment where he's like, I have the upper hand against Jack here.
Here's the thing that Jeff said that we talked about in terms of daddy issues and God issues and all that sort of stuff that I want to raise you guys, and we can talk about in the calm future. But, like, this idea that Jack, because his father let him down all his life, has become a person who needs to feel like, I can only depend on me. It is just me, despite his whole live together, die alone thing. Like, he's the leader. It's him. He can't depend on people, but he wants to encourage people to depend on him, right? And so he can't believe in God. He can't believe in the universe. He can't believe in the island. He can't believe in the coincidence of Desmond being there, because that would open him up to being vulnerable to something that, like, his father has made him just, close himself in on himself. And Locke had a similarly, like, much more harrowing experience with his father, but Locke is the kind of person who has opened himself up, continually tries to open himself up. And in the end, Jack becomes more like Locke in order to save the island. Jack being on a journey to go from being Jack to being John can't make that end goal John the villain or antagonist. His journey is to open himself up the way that John has opened himself up. And does John do stupid bad things in the name of his faith often? Yes. But, like, ultimately the show is arguing that, you know, there's a reason why Jack is the last person in the Flash sideways to, like, you know, wake up to the church. Because he's holding tight to this thing. And, like, the whole thing is about his journey to letting it go and becoming more like John. It's never been easy, but that's the journey that he's on. And so, like, you can't say that what he's working towards is the villainy of the show, you know? Dave?
I mean, I think it has much more to do with, like, your views on, like, faith in general, because I agree with everything that you said. I just don't agree that pushing the button is productive to that journey for Jack.
I think it is. I think what's true.
Both he and Locke get so taken with this fucking button that they completely reverse their positions by the time, like, everything goes to shit.
I think what's true is that Locke, pushed too hard. He's trying to be like, come sit here with me where I am and see it from my point of view. And Jack's like, I'm not ready. And Locke's like, I'm gonna fucking make you ready. And that's too hard, too much, too fast. You need to leave a trail of breadcrumbs on the ground up to your hand and let the baby bird hop its way forward to you. You know what I mean? Like, you can't just push someone to faith. You have to draw them to faith. And, like, eventually Locke does push Jack to faith. Well, technically, I think Ben pushes Jack to faith by killing Locke. Like, that's the whole thing that happens right at the end of the series is that, and sorry, I'm rewatching season 5 right now, but like what, season 5, is you know, like,
who knows anymore?
Is like Ben kills Locke, and then everyone keeps telling, like, Locke tells Jack and Ben tells Jack that all these people that he left behind on the island are suffering because he left, because he was not supposed to leave, because it was his fault. He did it by leaving. So he has to go back in order to fix it. And so they prey exactly on Jack's vulnerable point, right, to get him to go back. But in going back, in buying into even deeper into his savior complex, Jack has to accept the, you know, the mysteries of the island, has to give himself over to the mysteries of the island. And that's a hard, hard journey for Jack. It's just Locke is pushing him too hard here. He pushes him hard again later by dying. But, you know, I think it's misguided. I don't think it's villainous.
Again, I agree with a lot of what you're saying, but Jack always goes back to the island or the incident doesn't happen, and that's not how time works. So it's like...
That happened too. Right? I just watched an episode where Faraday's like sighing in his tie and explaining time, and I'm just like, oh, Dave Gonzalez, get off my TV.
No, I'm there, ties and all. Always. I'll always be there.
Okay, I really like this, though, the idea
that... This is why you never read all the pages of your notebook, because you don't want to stumble across your future stuff.
What, Neil? What do you like?
No, I think this makes sense, because, okay, what is John Locke's sort of purpose here? I do think that there is an element, and this really comes through in Terry O'Quinn's performance a lot in this show, is that he straddles the line between feeling... You kind of go between feeling like John is trying to manipulate someone or John is trying to help them. Because I think John's experience with Jack up to this point is that Jack is a control freak. And maybe John's just trying to help him sort of move beyond that and have a little faith. But he does. Joanna's right. He pushes him a little too hard in this episode.
Well, I think it's been building to the push, because he's been working on Jack since he lifted him up off that cliff. And what
when he was running, around
for his ghost dad,
Ghost dad.
So it's like every time John and Jack have come across, they've had this thing, and at the end of season one in Exodus, they have the actual fight. The, you know, we were brought here for a reason, and then Jack's like, we have a Locke problem, and then I think he still thinks we have a Locke problem, but now all the teams have been reshuffled because of where the hatch is. So, I mean, again, I backed off villain. I'm not sure if I could back off antagonist. Definitely tragic. But
I feel like tragic is progress. We'll get there to the same page.
We'll definitely get there when
through our journal to the same page. It's fine.
When we get to the point in the series that, like, the island is, you know, like, bringing Anthony Cooper to the island, then it'll be a lot harder for me to hold this position. Okay. But as of right now...
Well, the thing is, like,
the island is bringing people to Jack, as far as we, like, know in the series. Like, we know that Aunt Lucy is there, even though Jack doesn't know he's there. We know Desmond's there, and Jack knows Desmond's there. We think that maybe, you know, Jack's dad is there, but it's definitely the black spoke monster has shown up. But it seems like a lot of people...
At least one more Jack family member is there.
Yeah, that's true.
Oh, that's another good Lost Star Wars mashup that I saw, is someone took a scene of Charlie talking to Claire, and he's like, you love Jack, don't you? And she goes, of course I do. Get it? Oh, it's good. It's good.
It's like a Star Wars.
It's like a Star Wars.
It's like a Star Wars. Okay, wait. What did I want to say? Okay, I don't want to remove Carlton Cuse from this situation, or J.J. Abrams, or Lloyd Braun, or Jeff Lieber, or whatever, who wrote the original, like, whatever. But I think what we have to accept, having seen the work that came after it, that the magic of Lost is really concentrated on Damon Lindelof. And Damon Lindelof is telling a story, the story that he knows to tell best, which is his own story, right? And so I see Jack and John, same name as one of our listeners pointed out, as like these warring factions inside of Damon. And this story is a progression of like how he went from Jack to John, or held on to the best of Jack to also include the best of John. And you know, whether, I mean, I don't think that Damon would say like, and then I achieved Nirvana by the end of Lost or anything like that. But like, I think that that's what he's trying to work through, are these like parts of himself, these warring factions of himself. And that's part of what the story is about. And how those selves can connect to other people. That's my.
Let me tell you, they were at war for a while. That's gonna be a whole season of this.
That is my weekly unified theory of Lost that I wanted to share with y'all. Anyway,
yeah, that checks out.
This is a good episode of Lost. You know,
there's going to be more Hatch mysteries coming up. We're going to get to talk about different stations. We're going to get to talk about why Pierre Chang isn't called Pierre Chang in like different episodes. I'm really
the show
forward.
Is almost immediately going to present in your face the idea that this is all just a psychological experiment, which is a throwaway line in this episode, but then becomes a whole thing in another episode, which I love.
It's going to be great. It's going to be great. Neil, where are we headed next week on the island?
Oh, well, we're heading into the past of a lottery winner in Everybody Hates Hugo, which is a Hurley episode. Guess what? Oh, they already know. We're in the storm. Hurley's name is Hugo. Also, hey. I think we know that in the calm, too. Anyway, it's the first of like three or four straight great Hurley episodes. Not straight, but like... Of the next couple of Hurley episodes, they're all good.
Yeah, I think, yeah.
It's like this, and then the next one, and then Trisha Tanaka is dead, right? Those three are really so great together.
Sawyer says, who the hell is Hugo Reyes, and why does he have millions of dollars? So that
was oh, yeah, when he's on the raft, one. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Can I give a shout-out to... something we didn't talk about, but a great article that a bunch of our listeners are passing around.
Yeah,
sure.
It's on the site 25 years later site.com, which I believe is a Twin Peaks ish thing. Anyway, the article, which went up 4 days ago from when we're recording this, is called Lost: True Constant with Sentimentality, and That's a Good Thing, by Hannah Searson. And it's about sort of some of the stuff that we've talked about in terms of like connecting with other people, and how that is like a lost, an important lost theme. It's a stormy article, but this is a storm, so thought I'd raise it. And I think it's a really good read. So give it a read. And thanks for writing it, Hannah. You don't listen to this podcast, but I just thought I'd say it. All right. That's all.
Shout out to you and your Lost article. Mm-hmm. It's very good.
Excellent. While people are visiting other places on the internet to see some stuff, where can people find more of our work? Let's continue this week with Joanna Robinson.
Oh, yeah, you can find me on fannyfair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. I got to interview Devin Odessa, who played Sharon Chersky on My So-Called Life, for the My So-Called Life podcast. I'm doing Boiler Room Cast, and she was a frickin' delight. So you can listen to that at boilerroomcast.com and listen to that interview. It was lovely speaking to her. So that's what's going on with me. Next week on Little Gold Men, we have the great Karina Longworth talking about her new series of Katie Rich and I will talk to Karina Longworth next week on Little Gold Men. So you'll want to tune in for that.
Okay. Karina Longworth, a woman who can talk about minstrelsy with authority and no shame this week on her Song of the South podcast.
Dave's it's amazing. Dream girl.
It is pretty great. I have been restraining sending her a DM of congratulations until next week when she's going to go deeper into it. Anyway, but I'll get there. Neil, where can people find more of your work online?
Yes, you can get me at filmschoolrejects.com. You can always follow me on Twitter at rejects. Also, if you're a member of our Patreon, patreon.com/stormofspoilers, very hyped about the almost hour and a half long Star Wars episode that we did as a bonus episode last week. So, you know, if you're thinking about pulling the trigger on that Patreon, now is the time.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA70. You could find me on the Fighting in the War Room podcast. And here, as always, at the end of the podcast, telling you right before the Lost Suspense noise to not fall down.